begin. I was looking over the lecture for next week on morality and faith, and it struck me that a lot of because of the way I'm handling now, a lot of that argument is a negative argument against the idea of the supersensible substrate. As you know, that Kant has this worry about the relationship between freedom and causality, and in order to get around this, he tries to imagine that maybe there's some substrate that is neither freedom nor causal, and it just seems to me one of his silliest and worst ideas. And that's what I was going to talk about a lot next week. And I can do that and talk about art and morality. Or, since it's our last week, I thought I could give the lecture I'm just finishing and planning to give tomorrow on Picasso, which is takes up almost all the ideas we're dealing with in the course, about meaning, about life, about the relationship between art and materiality, and about the role of art in our judgments about the world instead. So you have a choice, and democracy is always what rules around here, more or less, sometimes, occasionally, a little bit. Plebiscitary democracy, you know, cheap, easy, yeah, enough, that's right. That's right. So, so you have a choice between either a pizza and wine with Picasso or pizza and wine with the question of art and morality, given, as I said, that I'm doing a lot of that already. So those in favor of Picasso... very wise. Okay. And we're going to assume that that works and it will be full of pictures. And it will be actually dealing with all the issues. And I'll give it as we're lecture format for about an hour. And then we can use the response to it to ask all the other questions about the con that are lingering and remaining over. Because there really is, as you will see, a real confluence about what I'm worried about and what I have to say about Picasso. Okay, any other mechanical issues? Right. So, and you're not to have dinner before next week, that will provide food of some sort, pizza. Okay, so last week, I ran one argument and then began another. The argument I ran concerned the Kant's system of the arts and the structure of the argument was the following, that unlike almost any other account of the system of the arts, Kant's is intended to be pluralist. That is, he runs an argument about the irreducibility of the different arts to one another, and he does so on the basis of an implicit idea of what he calls ideal or complete communication, where the idea of complete communication had three elements to it. Concept, gesture, and sensation. And a complete communication would be an ideal synthesis of all of these. But in fact, the argument runs, ordinary communication
falls woefully short of the idea of ideal or complete communication, the consequence of which is that art picks up or responds to all those things that the existing means of communication fails. So that the very existence of art, on Kant's account, is a response to unexpressed or unexpressed needs for communication that existing means of communication fail. And that the plurality of the arts sensation referring to the arts that are akin to music, gesture to those that are akin to painting and sculpture, and concept to those that are akin to poetry, right? Those are irreducible to one another. That each of those arts are attempts to give expressivity to those unmet or unsatisfied demands for communication. And I drew the analogy with Judy Butler's notion of rogue speech, in the sense that art is the speaking of that which has remained unspeakable in accordance with existing communicative modes. So that there is, in everyday communication, I argued, a deficit of communication built into everyday communicability itself, and the plurality of the arts in their medium specificity, and I'll have to say more about medium specificity later, but the claim is that each of these areas, including sensation, are potentialities of meaning. So that what Kant is here suggesting is that the notion of meaning cannot be reduced to the notion of determinate meaning, which is to say that scientific meaning, which is the ideal of fully determinate communicability, itself is a form of unwanted hegemony over communication itself, and that the development of the individual arts is the development in ways that cannot be either controlled or predicted of the potentialities for meaningfulness in these non-conceptual domains. As a consequence, instead of a system of arts, I argued, there is at most a solidarity of the various arts with one another. So that the last thing we want is the complete or ideal communication. Ideal art, which is all the arts in one. To put it another way, the attempt to translate one form of art into another form of art is a denial of the structural and material possibilities of meaning that human embodiment involves, which is why I had an endless series of communications this summer with Ken Wark. Ken is the author of Hacker Manifesto. What's the other one?
Gamer Theory.
And Ken is a real exponent of digital world, and including digital art. For me, digital art is the death of art, necessarily, because it is exactly the thought of the translatability of all media into just one, an underlying digital structure. We exchanged emails madly for several months, and then as we got fed up with one another, but we're still talking. One of the most talented young thinkers around. He's really something else. Okay, so that was my claim, is that in a sense the arts are all necessarily intimate communications, almost idiolects, and that there is each of them, how do I want to put this? The beauty of art is that art is born to failure, unlike science, which is born to success. That art can only succeed by failing because it can only inhabit its domain of the idiolect. It can only acknowledge its own limitations, its own inadequacies, and plunge into that structure of particular meaning, that is in intentional indifference to other forms of meaning. So art is always fragile, always unpredicted. In that sense, in ways I'll come back to when I talk about genius, always in a sense unjustifiable except in its very existence. That art cannot be grounded or rationalized or founded. The very notion of art is that it must, to succeed at all, transgress beyond existing norms of communication. Any questions about that run of argument? Yeah.
So the arts of speech that are based on concept are distinct, categorically distinct from the arts of gesture and sensation, but yet at the same time, as an art, are somehow related to sensation.
Absolutely. And indeed, the art of what distinguishes poetry from discursive argument is that there are domains of materiality, of meaning, say, for example, by means of sound or meter, right, that contribute to meaning but are not themselves conceptual. Yeah.
Does that affect the categorical, that they're separate from each other also?
In the case of poetry, in the case of all of them, you might say they're all structures in dominance. No, sensation isn't pure. You may say sensation is a structure based on not just sound, but on rhythm and meter. And then you can go on to say rhythm and meter will pick up notions of gesture. Indeed, we can't think of rhythm and meter without the notion of gesture. About the rhythm of the heart, or so on. So they intersect with one another, but they, as each domain, they accept their, if you want, their material conditions of possibility rather than fight against it. So they are, in that sense, perfectly finite, in the sense that their limitations, what makes them limited and insufficient, are also their conditions of possibility. So part two of my argument then went on to say that this idea of partial communication or indeterminate communication gets thematized in Kant very explicitly in the notion of aesthetic ideas. So aesthetic ideas are going to be in part the content of what Kant is concerned with. And I began by tracking the run of argument that begins on page 314. Where he defines aesthetic ideas as presentations of the imagination which prompt much thought, but to which no determinate thought whatsoever, that is, no determinate concept, can be adequate, so that no language can express it completely and allow us to grasp it. And then the next page and a half is an attempt to lay out the consequences of this notion of aesthetic ideas, which are meaningful intuitions. And as I was hinting at last week, in Critique of Pure Reason, there is a wall or boundary between concept and intuitions. That you only know what an intuition is in virtue of the concept it falls under. And that seems to be the point of the deduction of the categories of the First Critique. Throughout the entire Third Critique, I've been arguing that reflective judgment is a continual attempt to say that the notion of intuition has more complexity, more meaningfulness to it than the notion of concept fully accounts for. And that reflective judgment is the way in which we initially do that. We are now getting a further elaboration of that idea through the notion of aesthetic ideas, because they are themselves intuitions of a certain kind, presentations. Which are suggestive, in ways we'll have to come to, suggestive of thoughts, ideas, feelings, and the like. Which is to say, they are, for Kant, they, put it this way, they aim at cognition. They aim at cognition. They do not aim at mere sensation. That's an agreeable art. That would be like gastronomy, right? The art of good cooking. That aims at putting things together to produce a certain sensation. Right? So art aims at cognition. But a cognition, and so all this just sounds almost uncanny, that no concept, no determinate concept, not no concept, but no determinate concept can get on level footing with, and therefore they extend beyond the powers of discursivity. So Kant takes it as obvious that there is meaning independent of or not wholly absorbable by conceptual meaning. And he begins to unpack this through a series of steps. And the first thing he wants to say is that even to begin thinking about this, we have to begin thinking about it as the imagination. So what we're interested in here, of course, we're interested in creations, imaginative creations. And when we get to genius, it's going to be all about the powers of creative imagination, which in Kant is called the productive imagination. And Kant says that the productive imagination creates, as it were, another nature out of the material that actual nature gives it. We use it to entertain ourselves, and when experience strikes us in an overly routine way. So the notion of a second nature at least means the following, according to this paragraph, namely that a given intuition sets us off thinking about something utterly different from what we would normally think of when faced with an intuition of that kind. That is, he's being kind of Humean about this. He says, well, if struck with a flower, right? There's a flower, okay? And you have your normal associations of flower, right? So the mechanism is of associations. Flower is plant with trees, blah, blah, blah. Then go look at the Georgia O'Keeffe's and the Met. You're not going to think about trees or biology. You're going to think about, the most intimate versions of human sexuality imaginable, which is to say, it's an intuition, her painting of a flower, that sets us off necessarily associating with that image another set of associations, another set of ideas, which then come to belong to, right, that, and give us ways of thinking about it. So when we're looking at Georgia O'Keeffe, you may say that we're both thinking about flowers in ways we had not before, but equally we're thinking about human sexuality and the female form in ways we had not before. And they set up associations that are therefore fresh or new and allow us to think about each. Hence, the notion of a second nature is at least taking first nature and giving it a range of meanings and associations that it would not have on its own. Which is to say, we break from the laws of cause and effect, and we enter into, laws of association or connection that belong to cognition and meaning itself. And it's part of how we begin to think about what sexuality is, how it is reveled in, how it is dramatized, how, etc., etc. I thought that was a very delicate description of an embarrassing set of associations. Kant then goes on to suggest. So part of this, though, is I want to say that first nature is eclipsed, or that the mechanisms that rule first nature are supervened upon by meanings that are not intrinsic to it. And because it is supervened upon by meanings that are not intrinsic to it, there is no exact boundary to these things. So there's no full or determinate statement of what a Georgia O'Keeffe flower is meant to say. You can say the obvious, but once you, as it were, say the obvious, you are leaving just about everything that's significant unsaid. Part of this equally means to say, in ways I'll come back to in the second half, that that nature is no longer conceived of as determined by the rules of Newtonian science alone. That is, that there is more to nature than cause and effect discourse allows. And the issue here, and the issue that I want to, there is an extraordinarily interesting debate in the New European Journal of Philosophy, where John McDowell responds to Bob Pippin's essay in the McDowell Reader, and then Pippin responds to McDowell. And part of this is about this question of second nature that Steve was asking about. And at least both of them want to say something like the following that I want to save off for the discussion of Picasso next week, but it's going to be this. What I want to say about the Georgia O'Keeffe is that the meanings she allows us to attach to the notion of flower is not a mere projection upon the notion of flower. That in some sense we want to say the thought of nature having meanings that are not, that are above and beyond its causally reductive structure, are not mere matters of projection, and that they are things that arise because of, or in the light of, our human, free, and determined habitation in a natural world, but that are nonetheless objective. So this notion of second nature is the reason why it's such a fraught area, is it's asking how post-Newtonian nature can mean in ways that do not fall afoul of the claim, which is the standard claim from the point of view of reductionist science, that we simply project human meanings onto nature, and that if we stop projecting, what we discover is its mechanism all the way down. So to take seriously the notion of aesthetic ideas, and I'll come to this later today in part as well, to take seriously the thought of artworks is to take seriously the thought that there is more potential in both the materials of nature themselves, sounds, rhythms, meters, all stuff which can, by the way, be dealt with and analyzed in purely causal ways. But there is more to it than that, and that more to it is neither fanciful nor merely projection. The way in which, remember, the problem here is this, that the archetypal object of projection, of course, is God. Right? There are no gods. We project the idea of God into the world, and Enlightenment taught us, beginning with the Greeks, that it was a mere projection. Well, the claim of Newtonian science was, so is all meaning of the natural world a mere projection. Newton totally disenchanted the world, including and above all, which is why I want to talk about Picasso next week, the human body. The human body, as Descartes and Kant insist, is a machine. So the question is, can we have a notion of meaning, of nature, that is not merely, again, the cultural projection of ideas onto it? So something about the way in which we judge artworks and think artworks operate has to bear that weight of supervenience without falling afoul of the notion of willful projection.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how that, maybe I should just go read it, how does that relate to the debate you brought up?
Because, right, well, in part, I'll just do the quick version of it. The quick version of it is McDowell is always too fast to drop the notion of first nature and let second nature be meaningful all by itself. This was the problem in that same book edited by Nick Smith. That was my critique of McDowell. He does not take account, he thinks disenchantment is a merely epistemic error, and that roughly, in perfectly McDowellian-like ways, once we stop philosophizing, right, once we stop having bad philosophical ideas, then the whole world will appear as second nature and everything will be fine. As if the disenchantment of the world were not a social fact, as well as a certain structure of scientific thought. So that what Pippin wants to do is to take seriously the Hegelian thought which is an extension of the Kantian thought, that all meaning must be attached to an I think or we think. And that, in a certain way, therefore, we cannot have an understanding of the possibilities of meaningfulness without some notions of the way in which meaning can fail, in the way in which it could be a projection, or it could be a mere willfulness, or it could be something that was merely instituted, and not, as it were, something stronger than that. And that notion of failure, you might say, is what McDowell insufficiently recognizes. Right? That's certainly one of Pippin's, I think, pointed critiques of McDowell on that. Okay. Press on to the next paragraph. Such presentations of the imagination we may call ideas. One reason for this is that they do at least strive towards something that lies beyond the bounds of experience, and hence try to approach an exhibition of rational ideas, and thus these concepts are given a semblance of objective reality. So Kant's claim here, which I'm going to say is not actually persuasive to me, he says one of the reasons we call aesthetic, the kind of intuition at stake here, aesthetic ideas, is that they strive to express rational ideas, and rational ideas are ideas of reason, which are exactly those ideas like freedom and virtue that are, for Kant, necessarily outside of the natural world, outside what can be experienced, that is, in intercourse with the natural world, because they are noumenal. So this is his own two-world theory really structuring the form of his argumentation here. So his thought is that aesthetic ideas are an attempt to give what he calls a semblance of objectivity, by which he means here presentation in the objective world. He doesn't mean by objectivity truth here, he just means exhibitability in intuition, something that can be an object for us. A semblance, that's right, he calls it objective reality, and that's right, he can make it real in the objective world. Another reason, and now he thinks about this a second longer, and he thinks maybe something else is at stake here. Another reason, indeed, the main reason for calling these presentation ideas is that they are inner intuitions to which no concept can be completely adequate. So now his thought is, very peculiar sentence that. I'm going to call this intuition an idea because ideas are the sorts of things for which no concept, no determinate concept can be given, and that therefore they are like ideas in their indeterminacy. So it's really, he's operating, I think, on an analogy or a simile of like, because sharing in the kind of indeterminacy from conceptual determination that ideas have. And poet, he then goes on to explain his sentence. A poet ventures to give sensible expression to rational ideas of invisible things. The realm of the blessed, the realm of hell, eternity, creation, and so on. Or again, and now he's changing topic, it's important. So the first reign is give expression to things that are themselves necessarily invisible. Well, that's going to make them odd. But now he changes his mind. He says, or again, he takes things that are indeed exemplified in experience, things that are themselves phenomenal, such as death, envy, and all the other vices. Interesting, only the, as well as love, fame, and so on. But then, by means of an imagination that emulates the example of reason, in reaching for a maximum, he ventures to give these sensible expressions in a way that goes beyond the limits of experience, namely with a completeness for which no example can be found in nature. Well, I've been thinking about Kant for off and on for about 40 years now, this text, and I have no idea what he means by maximum and completeness here. What does it mean to think about envy completely, or the maximum of envy, or the maximum Right? Now, the reason he's using the notion of maximum completeness is because that's what rational ideas are. They're always ideas of the unconditioned or some totality. So his intuition is that somehow art must be thinking about those things in that way. I can make no sense of that claim. What would completeness mean here? Sorry, I mean, it was not a great idea. A dime?
Try.
15 cents? I mean, come on. Insult. I'm going to come back shortly to this, but I want to suggest... I want to make one suggestion here, and then I'll make a further set of suggestions later. What do artworks do? Now, I want to take seriously why he's tempted by the idea of completeness and maximum. Intuition about why he'd be tempted in that way? Yeah?
Well, there's, I mean, when a lot of it's empty particulars, at that point you almost sort of gave us a little aside and you said, I wonder if the same thing can't be said for ethics in terms of, can ethics really bear anything more than exemplary particularity? So sort of, this is what it means to be a good friend. And so if by showing you by example what it means to be a good friend, that's sort of taking that idea to the maximum to say, just this, I'm showing you what it means, I can't tell you any better than that.
Okay. That, I think, is great. What is it? Now, can you think of a different way of thinking about that? Can you expand that idea? What would it mean to expand that idea?
And Nicole kind of said I may be expanding in the wrong direction. But, so, I mean, if we were to take some of the things you just mentioned, so, for instance, we can... Shakespeare is going to give us Iago and say, this is what it means to be evil or deceitful or cunning. Or he's going to give us, you know, I mean, sort of, this is what it means to be this, this is what it means to be that.
I think that's absolutely right. So the question is, what is art doing when it's doing that? And my suggestion is the following. Now, what art is doing is not giving merely an essential definition, although it can sound that way. And Heidegger, in The Origin of the Work of Art, often talks that way. And that just seems to me a mistake. It's not the essence, exactly, that he's interested in. But it's something analogous to it, and it's this. That what an artwork reveals is that for the item under discussion, that item is a transcendental condition for the possibility of experience for us. That is, each work of art, I would argue, is a kind of transcendental deduction, namely of the necessity, or let's call it the categorical status, of a particular idea. So that the reason why ideas in artworks cannot be judged true or false in the ordinary way is because he's not, the question an artwork raises, here's an image of what love is like in the world, that would be just a correspondence theory of truth. And that's not what art does. You may say sociology of love may do that, right? That's, you may want to do, you know, the Becks or Luhmann on love in the modern world. That's what they're doing. They're trying to say, here's a picture of what love is now operating like. Artwork is doing something else. Namely, we cannot make sense of our lives unless this concept has this kind of bearing for us. So that each work of art, as I want to express it, is attempts to bear the burden of human significance. That is, how human experience means at all. But not, of course, with respect to everything, but simply with respect to this. So it is not surprising that in a world in which, for example, so much of our lives are based on intimate relationships, that we have novels that are, you know, all about love or marriage or friendship or desire, because those are the ways in which we are attempting literally to make sense of our own lives. So that what art does, it can't be matched against the world because it is itself, I want to say, philosophical. In that sense, using the notion of aesthetic idea is exactly right. It is the attempt to reveal or disclose or exhibit how a range of experience that circulates around a particular phenomenon comes to bear the burden of meaningfulness for us, and without which we suddenly feel that, or we suddenly feel when in touch with it, that that gets closer to us than our own lives. So that sometimes when I am listening to Casals playing Bach, I know what grief is. I know that life is grievable. That life is grievable. I can only make sense of that thought in relationship to those sounds. Those sounds in that pattern are the grievability of life, and the thought that life could be other than that, that is, that thought not attached to life, is refuted by that music. That music has to bear the weight of that claim. I think that's why aesthetic ideas cannot be made determinate. Because there's no object they're corresponding to. They are indeed ideas in partially consense, but now without the phenomena-noumena distinction. The phenomena-noumena distinction, I'm suggesting, leads him on a series of red herrings, yet everything he says about aesthetic ideas is better than the phenomena-noumena distinction, and hence better than his idea that aesthetic ideas express rational ideas or symbolize them, and better than the notion of completeness or maximum. Although I'm again saying that if we use the phrases maximum or completeness themselves metaphorically as expressive of bearing the burden of human significance, then there is a kind of frankness to.
How is this different than the romantic fragment? Or the romantic, I mean,
comes right out of this.
Right.
I mean, it's just right out of it.
Yeah.
The romantic fragment is take this, junk the rest, and you've got a whole philosophy.
Yeah.
I mean, roughly, I think the romantic fragment grew out of 10 paragraphs of the Third Critique, roughly 40 to 51. And that would be, if someone wants to write a PhD on that, that's fine. I haven't a new thought, but yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, this just sounds very similar to me, to the safe place that we need in order to see the sublime. So how, when you're in the experience of grief, you're not giving a transcendental deduction of grief, that you need the place of the Bach in order to.
That's right. So one of the things I'm going to speak about, well, I've already spoken about, that I'm saying that art arises out of, as I suggested with tragedy itself, out of the failures of communication in everyday life. That everyday life does not give us the articulacy of our fundamental commitment. So, of course, to claim that, as I am, that every work of art enacts a kind of transcendental deduction, I'm, for those of you who know, I'm kind of half paraphrasing Stanley Cavell, when he draws an argument from Emerson. Emerson says, every word they say chagrins us. Crazy. Just devastating statement. Every word they say chagrins us. It's like listening to my president. Right? Every word they say chagrins me. Powerful ways. To which Crevel's response is, Kant was wrong about thinking there were only 12 categories. Every word of the language can suddenly seem to us as in need of a transcendental deduction. I think that's right. That's why I'm skeptical about both the number of categories and Hegel's logic. Every word can suddenly be in need of a transcendental deduction because we do not know what word, what range of experience will suddenly be the one we need to make sense of for our lives. Right? You may think, I can go on, you can just imagine how this unfolds. So, I don't know how I got onto that. Every range is a possible need of transcendental deduction.
Including the infinite, to get back to the sublime.
In principle, of course, I mean, you know, you can always play the game, right? You can play the game just the way you can play the game with Plato's ideas, right? Socrates, is there an idea of mud? To which Socrates says, well, if there are ideas, then there are ideas of mud, right? And he's just going to just go with it, right? So my answer is, sure, why not? I mean, I'm committed to the thought that mud and the infinite can both be in need. I'm not saying they are in need, that I can imagine the cases of need. All I'm saying that is it's an unregulated sphere because, again, what I'm claiming is the limits of the failures of communication and communicability, and we don't know where we're going to need the help or the range or what's going to confront us to make it palatable.
Yeah? Why do you think Kant privileges poetic expression as far as the best medium through which he communicates?
Because poetic expression is closest to language, therefore closest to the work of the imagination itself. Since he thinks of, so that there is, and there's some wonderful essays by Jane Neller on this. Jane's been doing great work on trying to show how the notion of the imagination has to bear the burden of everything that the imagination has the job of secularizing the noumenal. That's roughly what Jane wants to say that romanticism is really about. The romanticism hears what I've just said and then goes toward secularizing everything by turning it into poetry. So it's the proximity between poetry, language, and imagination, which is to say that language for everyone from even earlier than Lessing, but right on through the Romantics, everyone assumes the arbitrariness of language. And the arbitrariness of language means its impossible malleability. So that it's the very malleability of language, the arbitrariness of the signifier, if you're Saussurean, that makes it usable by the imagination in the way that, for example, Lessing famously argues in Laocoon,
you've got a block of marble, you've got all sorts of problems about time, about relationship between beauty and ugliness. I mean, go on, constraints just pile up. So imagination is the most free. So the notion of freedom, the notion of imagination, and the notion of language form a constellation that you might say is the constellation of the Schlegel brothers. And there are explicit paragraphs in the Athenaeum. I'm going to later suggest, I'll just be quick now, following an argument of Kirk Pillow's, that the free play is form and aesthetic ideas is going to be content. And I'm going to say that the form is the form of the beautiful, the content is sublime. So that's going to be the Pillow thesis, we will call it.
And then my other question is just, I'm having trouble figuring out how to limit formally how this aesthetic experience comes out of certain forms, and just why couldn't it be any phenomenal experience that generates this sort of aesthetic idea or free play?
The answer is any experience can. What the arts do is bind themselves to the rigor of their medium as a way of doing this as a practice. So the difference between art and, as it were, the rest of life is not that we don't use metaphors all the time, use gestures all the time, sometimes hit levels of oratorical power and expressivity, but it's an accident. Art is that domain of practice that aims at this and takes it up. So it is, let's say, the making explicit of these differential structures and the elaboration of them in light of the deficits of communication in everyday communicability.
Yeah? I'm not exactly sure where to take this, but you know, you say you're listening to Gesell sing Bach, and it's the most, you know...
Gesell's play Bach.
Play Bach.
Cello.
You listen to Bach, and you know you feel the world is grievable, and it's really, it's really in there. But at the same time, we can say, well, if you want to feel the world is grievable, you can turn on any radio station and grieve at it. And it's because Bach is interesting, because it makes you enjoy the grieving, and not only enjoy it, perhaps enjoy it because you have no choice but to grieve while listening to it. And I don't know if this is, you know, it's retracing territory we've gone.
Yeah, that was just a question before.
Yeah. Okay, well.
What I want to say is that a community that can fully acknowledge grievability in the way that I am suggesting, if I can have it as part of its culture, is a community that is more likely to really respond to the grief of a particular experience when it comes in contact with it, because that grief will now have a standing or status or shared rationality that it would not have if it was just a singular experience of, oh God, that's awful! Turn off the thing, make a popcorn. So, I mean, Art is limited. It's not practice. It's not ethics. It's not politics. It's what we have when those things are failing us in radical and systematic ways. All art is about the absence of a politics or an ethics that we could own. And it is, I would argue, I have no idea, if we had the politics we think we ought to have, I do not know if we would have anything like an art culture. That's Schiller's argument, that art only arose when Greek politics failed. That the great age of Greek art, is the argument of the aesthetic education, arose as Greek political culture declined
It is always memorial or utopian. Art is always a memory or a hope of a engagement that is failing us. But that goes along with the definition I started with, the deficit in communication. If there were no deficit, then there wouldn't be this need that art answers to and we feel struck by when we come across it. Art would be answering to anything. Photography, for example, is not an art medium. Photography is a technology that can be used for a variety of purposes, including advertising, snapshots, and art. Right? In the case of music, the capacities of digitalization are being supervened by the desire to have the art of music, the art of sound, right, transmitted. That's all. As Benjamin says, we're not leaving the world of mechanism behind. A certain supervenience on it, including, of course, digital ones. There's no purity here. There's no purity. That's why I want to keep the question of mechanism going. Let the question of mechanism die, and then you have some fantasy of purity. I don't see any justification for that.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't pin it down, and you've been saying things which run in both directions, and maybe it is both, but is art a mode of production or a mode of consumption? Or, like, you know, not consumption, but a relation with the object?
Art is a human practice of production and consumption. It is the production of objects, Kant says, for the purposes of expressing aesthetic ideas.
So the production is fundamental to have art. Like, it is producing for aesthetic experiences art.
Yeah.
So you cannot relate artistically to something that was not produced for that purpose.
That's right. We've already done, we've been spending, you know, we spent 13 weeks, yeah. 12 weeks, on the aesthetics of nature. And I'm asking, eventually I'll have to come back and say more about how nature relates to this. But I'm trying to, my suggestion from the beginning of this discussion is that Kant is simply more interesting on art than the notion of natural beauty would want one to anticipate.
Is it always that art communicates that which cannot be communicated, or is it sometimes that which is always communicated, we always already have in our communication, but just the exalted makes it beautiful? to be that art would somehow be giving us tapping into some resource that we no longer have or never had. On one hand, and on the other hand.
But then there has to be a need. There has to be a need. Art is not the same as mere fantasy, cooking up some crazy idea.
For that, just go to the New York subway.
Crazy people are all over. We're not trying to cook up crazy ideas. We're trying to answer needs for communication. So felt needs that have been not responded to. Beauty is the form in which those reach perspicuous presentation. Perspicuous because, as I'll get to, I guess in a second, because of the structure of purposiveness without purpose. Yeah.
So this is providing like an ontological, a way of distinguishing.
I never use the word ontology. We need to keep it really clean here. Now, I mean, of course, there are good uses of ontology. It just, with Kant, it's always, you know, like stepping in quicksand. You just never get out of it.
All I meant by it is just, it seems that what I have in mind is contemporary art. And it seems that there is emerging a way of distinguishing what would count as sort of true art in one sort of sense, art that does do this, from a bunch of stuff that is culturally called art that fails to do this. And so that's a way of distinguishing what is, and that way we can say, yeah, but that stuff is not art, which is, of course, one of the main things that art is now about, or was about, was extending the barrier to what counts. Because a lot of this just doesn't seem at all relevant to contemporary art, or much less so.
As soon as art becomes art, then the question will arise of necessity. This will bear exactly on the question of genius. Of necessity, is it really art? Because each artwork is going to be a new step along the way in the capacities for human meaningfulness. And because it is going to be ungrounded, then any modern art, that is anything going to count as art, not religion or politics or whatever, is going to necessarily raise the question of fraudulence. Which is what all of Michael Fried's criticism is about, right? Absorption of theatricality. Theatricality is about fraudulence for him, and about how that question of fraudulence became bound up with certain moments of art. Yeah, Joe.
Just, you mentioned Fried. I mean, one of the things he takes about minimalism is that it collapses the media distinctions and makes sculpture look like painting, or, you know, because you can't really decide what they are.
Yep.
So would there be a distinction between things that are simply troubling in their novelty and thing? I mean, because I take what he was objecting to, and that was that he saw it as an actual attack on the foundations of aesthetic experience, which rests in some ways on this Kantian division of media.
Right.
So would there be a distinction between art that's new and dangerous in a way that still allows art to stand, and art that's too dangerous that seems to threaten the very existence of the what makes it art?
Right. I certainly would want to hold off the notion of too dangerous. No such thing as too dangerous. There are simply occasions, there are lots of possibilities of failure, and the question is, how much failure is courted. So take Tony Smith's Black Pew, right? I mean, a 6-foot, perfectly square black pew. That's certainly courting failure. Now, I have, in Against Voluptuous Bodies, a critique of Fried. I think he's wrong about minimalism. I don't think he can distinguish minimalism from the art he supports. Especially Nolan and Olitsky, who seem to be treacherously thin.
So, but that's our job. The job of criticism is to take up the burden of making those distinctions in significant ways. So that Michael will tell you, right, that, you know, all right, you know, he'll say to me, I'll make, you know, what I did is I used Frank Stella in his book Working Space. And I think there's a bit of Stella where Stella is actually criticizing Nolan, right, saying, yeah, this is really brittle, it's bad art. And I use that against Fried, and Fried says back to me, yeah, okay, but you're using my vocabulary. So that I am the one who is, and I think he's right, that is, that we keep discussing Fried's distinction, means that he hit the notion of the potential of fraudulence that, and he's right about this, that the Duchampians wanted to deny. So that the degree to which we find ourselves compelled by Fried is the way in which we cannot take Duchamp seriously. And I think, for myself, he won the argument. Right? That's my anti-Duchampian commitment. Yeah. But no, but just, I mean, I take it that the whole of nominalism in Duchamp has explicitly worked out by telling to do in the most thorough way, exactly cannot fully, although Deduve tries to bring in Kantian judgment, tries to bring in taste desperately, but I don't see how he can do it. He has no way of anchoring the notion of significant failure. And at least Fried is asking the question of pressing the issue that art must be capable of failure, or it cannot be capable of success. That's the argument. And that just strikes me as that much of Kantianism I want to buy into. Okay, well that was the